So I wanted to start a new mitzvah this week, as we're going back to our mitzvos. The mitzvah we'll discuss is actually a term which encompasses, I believe, four different mitzvos, four separate commands in the Torah. And, you know, often, if you've been to enough classes here, you know that the more obscure it is, the more I enjoy it. So this is a mitzvah which seems more obscure to us, but there's a lot of depth and meaning to it. I'll try to pull out that meaning. The mitzvah is referred to in Hebrew as kilayim, and that term encompasses four different mitzvahs, and we'll just go through them briefly one by one, and then we'll discuss them more in depth. The Torah says in the book of Vayikra, chapter 19, let me find it, verse 19, Eschukosai tishmoru, you should guard my laws, hemdechol osavia kilayim, essentially you should not crossbreed animals. Sarkal seeds are kilayim. You should not mix seeds in your field. The ven kilayim shatnez, and a garment which is shatnez, a mixture of wool and linen, lo yalelach, you should not put upon yourself. So this verse lists three different things, all grouped together and called kilayim. One kind of kilayim is crossbreeding animals. One is grafting trees, mixing plants, you know, planting seeds together. And the third mention in this verse is wearing a beged, a garment that's shatnez, which is a garment which contains wool and linen woven together. There is a fourth type of kilayim, which is mentioned later on in the Torah, in the book of Devarim, in chapter 22. And that is referred to in the verse, L'sach rosh b'shor v'chamur yachdav. You shall not plow with a donkey and ox together. So even though that one sounds a little bit different, the rabbis grouped that under the category of kilayim as well. So all these things are called kilayim. And essentially kilayim, in a more general sense, is mixing together things that don't belong. That's what we're talking about. Rav Hirsch writes, what does the term kilayim mean, the term in Hebrew? The term kilayim comes from the word kelo, which is to hold back. And Rav Hirsch says that these are things that naturally are unnatural pairs. They're held back from one another. All these things, we'll have to discuss why they're unnatural pairs, but all these things are unnatural pairs, odd couples in some way or another, and that's why they're referred to as kilayim. Things which should remain apart are coming together. So they're being held, things that should be held back, once they are fused together in some way, that's called kilayim. So Torah prohibits all these things. Now each category is a little bit different, has a different meaning, different implications. So we'll discuss each one by one. The first category was crossbreeding animals. So there is a prohibition in the Torah, a Jew cannot crossbreed different species. I guess the most common animal that we're aware of would be a mule, mating a horse and a donkey. And the prohibition of the Torah means actually physically mating the animals. You're allowed to lock them in a pen together. If they mate on their own, that's not your problem. But you're not allowed to physically force them to mate. If it happens naturally, it's okay. And once the offspring is, you're allowed to use the offspring. So if a mule is created, you're allowed to use the mule. It's not a problem. It's not that the mule is prohibited. But you're not, a Jew is not allowed to crossbreed different species. That's the first category of kilayim.
So if a Jew did crossbreed to create a mule, would a Jew be allowed to
use
the mule?
Yes, he could use the mule. Yeah.
Okay.
The second category was planting mixtures in your fields. So this applies primarily in the land of Israel, not outside of Israel. But it means that there's a few different ramifications for this. You can't plant different species of vegetables or grains together. You have to distance your crops. It has to be very clear. This is my corn crop. This is my wheat crop. This is my potato crop. Things have to be very clear as to where they're planted. They can't be mixed with one another. Additionally, you can't graft trees. So like, for instance, you have different fruits which are hybrids of two different types of fruits. So a Jew is not allowed to actually create those fruits. Inserting branches into one another to create different species, that's a problem. And if grapes are involved, it's even a more serious prohibition. When it comes to grapes, that even could apply outside of Israel. And if you were to crossbreed or plant grapes with other types of produce, then the outcome would be prohibited to use. Whereas if you were to plant your, for instance, we all eat nectarines or a crossbreed. Or a pluots. There are all sorts of, you can go into this grocery store and buy all sorts of things. Those are all okay to eat. A Jew shouldn't make them, but a Jew's allowed to eat them, not a problem. But if you were to plant a field with grapes and other crops mixed in that field, then the outcome is also prohibited to use. You have to destroy every single thing that grows in the field has to be destroyed. That's what the Torah says. So grapes are more serious. And that could apply even outside of Israel. So if you plan on planting grapes in your backyard, speak to the rabbi first. That's the everything else though does not apply outside of Israel. So if you're planting a garden in your house, it's okay to plant everything together. That's not an issue. But if you're planting grapes, you have to be more careful. The other two categories, one is wearing shatnez, which is a garment of a mixture of wool and linen. And that means that you have wool and linen that are actually sewn together within the garment. That's what that means. It's something which is not so uncommon to find. I actually saw recently, I was trying to buy, I think, a suit from Joseph A. Bank, and it's something called the tropical weave. And the tropical weave was a mixture of wool and linen together. So I stayed away from that one. And there are those who are trained to check for shatnez, so if you buy a garment and you need to know what it's made out of, you can bring it to the shatnez checker and have them check your garments. That's the idea of this third category of kilayim. And the fourth category is plowing with a donkey and an ox together, the Torah says. The rabbis actually tell us that it's not only an ox and a donkey, but any two species being worked together at the same time, that's a prohibition, that falls under that prohibition. Meaning if you were to tie any two species to the plow and have them plow your field, or have them even just move along a heavy burden, that's also pull your wagon. That's a problem if it's two different species, and we'll discuss that more as we go through, but that's the fourth category. Yeah.
You said the rabbis tell us, the rabbis telling us that
That's the Torah, the Doraisa. But it's not clear in the Pasuk itself, so the rabbis explain that includes everything. Okay, and we'll get back to more details in terms of all of them, but those are the general categories of Kilayim. Now I want to take them one by one and try to understand like what's the meaning behind these prohibitions. So the first prohibition, the first two really are the more similar prohibitions. Crossbreeding animals and mixing fruits and produce, those seem to relate to one another. Wearing a mixture of wool and linen seems to be a different kind of thing. We don't see how that relates, and certainly plowing with two animals is very different. But let's focus on the first two first. So we're dealing here with crossbreeding animals and mixing plants. Try to discuss each one on its own and understand what's the message or lesson it's teaching us. So first and foremost, we'll look at Rashi's commentary. Rashi points out on the verse in the Torah that we quoted, the one that actually encapsulates three of these forms of kilayim. The verse opens up with the terms "Eschukos Saitishmor," you should guard my laws. And the term used there is the word chok. And a chok always connotes a law which is not something which is so rational to understand. It's a law without an apparent reason. And Rashi explains to us on that verse. Rashi says, Elu gzeiros melech, these are decrees of the king. Shein tam adavar, there's no apparent reason for these decrees. So Rashi says, these are what we call in the realm of chok, something which is without an apparent reason, nothing that the human mind really understand what's the problem with it. That's what Rashi says. Quoting from the Midrash, this is what Rashi's telling us. The Midrash Tanchuma actually tells us this. The Midrash itself tells us, in a different verse, in the Parshas Mishpatim, it says, Eschukos Vaitishmor, Lechas Behem, you should guard my chukim, my laws, but this word chok again, to go in them, I am Hashem. And the Medrash says, well, maybe you'll say these are useless acts. Like, why do I have to keep something that makes no sense to me? It doesn't make any sense. So that's why the verse concludes, I am Hashem, that Hashem understands the reason. Meaning, maybe we don't understand the reason. We don't know why. But Hashem doesn't just command us things at whims. Don't make any sense. Hashem has a reason for them. Even though there's no apparent reason to it, and it's not an easy rationale, it's something which we still have to keep based on the fact that Hashem commanded them. That's what Rashi's alluding to. That's what the Medrash tells us. So let's just pause on this point for a second. I mean, this applies really to many, many mitzvahs of the Torah. It's something we have discussed in the past, but it's always good to revisit. There's a lot of mitzvahs that don't seem logical. You know, when we sit here in this class, we try to understand the rationale and the meaning behind certain mitzvahs. Some of them, you know, they don't make all that much sense to us. You know, every mitzvah may have elements of this. I mean, we understand why we shouldn't steal, but it could be that there's some details in the Torah's laws of theft, which don't quite make sense to us. There could be a chok within a rational mitzvah. And then some mitzvahs stand out that the mitzvah in its essence seems to be not rational. Such as possibly, like you're saying, kilayim. Why I can't mix wool and linen in my jacket, I mean, doesn't seem to make sense to us. Even why we can't eat milk and meat together. There are a lot of things that don't make sense to us. This is in the realm of chok. Now, a chok is something which challenges our emunah, our faith in God, and makes us submit to say that we don't understand everything. That's what a chok is supposed to do. A chok is an opportunity to say, despite the fact that it makes no sense to me, I believe that it came from God. I believe God knows the best for me, and therefore I'm going to perform the chok. I'm going to submit to God's will, despite the fact it's not rational. Now, that's a bigger challenge for some of us than others. Some people have a very hard time acting in ways that make sense to them. Some people are more submissive. But every person has their own challenges in these areas. But a chok is really a realm of the Torah. It's a whole section of the Torah. These irrational laws, which cause us to recognize the fact that we are human, we're limited, God knows best, we don't know best. And like the Medrash told us, that don't say that they're tohu, don't say that they're useless. Rather understand that God knows the benefits and we don't. So that's the realm of a chok. So Rashi is telling us that really this whole category called kilayim of these forbidden mixtures is really all a chok. And we really can't understand the reason for it. Another classic commentator, Rabbeinu Bachaya, points out that many mitzvahs are there in the Torah, and he quotes the term, lahagdil Torah lahadira, in order to increase the Torah and to make it great. And he says that God gives us many opportunities for reward. God wants to give us mitzvahs in all areas of life, so that no matter what we're going to do, we always have a chance to serve God and get eternal reward. So even though the mitzvah may be rational to us, God said, I want to put a mitzvah involved in planting, in clothing, in harnessing animals, in producing animals. So therefore, I'm going to give you certain commands and limitations and prohibitions that you can follow, and therefore, in every single act you do, in every activity in life, you're going to have a chance for eternal reward. That's what Rabbeinu Bachaya explains to us. But he says as well that even mitzvahs that don't seem to have any meaning to us, they all have meaning in a higher realm. I mean, a chok means that in our world, in our physical limited world, we don't understand the meaning of this. But he says in a higher realms, mystically, Kabbalistically, mitzvahs have major implications. And some may only be apparent in the heavens and not on earth. But that shouldn't stop us from performing it, because we're doing something in our world which is going to have vast implications in the heavenly worlds. And he says, for example, over here, on a very basic level, when God created the world and created every single species, so God gave each species, the rabbis tell us, its own powers, its own angels that supply it with blessing and with heavenly influence, which cause it to grow and to produce and to succeed. And when you start crossbreeding, you're messing up what's happening up in heaven. Because if every species, you know, there's an angel appointed to help out the horses. Angel appointed to help out the donkeys. But no angel was ever appointed to help out the mules. So when you create a mule, you're doing something which is going to cause confusion and tension up in the heavens. Again, we're simplifying a very deep concept. But his point is to show us that there's something in every single mitzvah which applies up in heaven, up in spiritual realms, which we may not see apparent on earth. And he says, it's kind of like, you know, we have the phrase, famous phrase, Osa Shalom Yirmav, God creates peace up in the heavens. So angels doing their jobs are all at peace. But when you put two predators in a cage with one another, so then there's no more peace, then there's tension. So you take the angel of the horse, you can take the angel of the donkey, and you stick them, okay, you guys are now both in charge of the mule. So that creates tension between two angels. Again, we're oversimplifying very deep concepts, but we can at least picture in our minds that there's something much deeper to that which we're discussing here. So before we begin into the possible rationales and meanings and lessons behind the mitzvahs, we have to understand that these mitzvahs, as well as many mitzvahs, fall into the realm of chok. Ultimately, our minds cannot fully wrap themselves around these mitzvahs. And any reason and that lesson we pull from it is going to be a lesson and a reason, but we're never getting to the bottom of it. And we can't get to the bottom of it. Yeah.
One was a comment. I went to these country magazines, and it says if you combine a donkey and however it is to make a mule.
Yeah.
The mule, I think it's the male, whatever it is, one of the mules, they can't give birth.
They can't reproduce, right.
They can't reproduce. And the other thing, I have a question about the wool and linen mixture. Isn't there like a famous story about, in Breishit, about, Cain and Hevel?
Right, right. Yeah, so we'll talk more about that this week later on. We'll get to wool and linen. But yeah. You're still sure. You're still sure.
Let's assume we're not allowed.
Yeah.
Why he forbid us, if we were permitted, to eat this beautiful meat, this beautiful meat? Why God's children to remind us of our limitations? What does he have to do it so systematically? We know they are limited. we know you. So why are we not allowed, we are barred from commandments?
It's a good question. It's a good question.
Why God made this choice? Why? Right. Do I have the right to interpolate him right? Can I say to interpolate right? Do I have the right to insist I want to know? Or shut up?
It's a good question. It's kind of beyond the realm of our topic right now. I'll just give you the short answer, which is that on the one hand, they said that there are many human beings out there. We don't see limitations. Some people, very arrogant people, who think that they can do whatever they want to do, conquer the world, that exists. We know that exists. Evil tyrants, terrible, wicked people, dictators who think that they are it, you know? The Torah even tells us that Pharaoh thought that he was a god. You know, he thought so highly of himself. He knew he was a human being, but he thought he was almost as powerful as God. So we have to constantly remind that we are limited. Also, I mean, the purpose of a human being in this world is to submit to God. And if we can understand everything, so then it's like the snake told Adam, told Chava, told Eve. The snake said, if you eat from the tree, you'll be like God, you'll know good and evil. Because knowledge is power, knowledge is everything. And if we can understand everything about the world, then what do I need God for? I understand everything. So it's not that God, you know, I have to submit to God, and also I have to recognize that God is beyond me. If God gave me the ability to understand everything, then I'll say, okay, I know as much as God, so I'm equal to him. That's a short answer to a big question, but that's part of it. So now we're going to enter into giving some lessons we learned from these mitzvahs, despite the fact that we have to always remember that they're a chok, and we're never going to fully understand exactly what the reason is. We always try to squeeze out the meaning. So, and again, some of these reasons will apply to specific instances of kilayim, and some will apply to the entire category of kilayim, but we'll see the meaning. So the Rambam, Maimonides, in his typical fashion, gives us, you know, a very logical, rational, you know, basic meaning to why we can't crossbreed animals. And the Rambam explains to us that in order to crossbreed animals, the Torah says, you're allowed to put them in a pen together. You just can't physically cause them to mate. To actually walk over and physically join the animals together. So the Rambam says, for a human being to engage in such an action, to physically cause animals to mate, it's such an undignified action, so inappropriate to engage in. God says you have to recognize your limits. You have to realize that sometimes, even though something might be beneficial to you, you want to have a mule. You like to have a mule. And the mule's going to be very good for you to help you in your work, and it's going to cause you a profit. But we have to lower our standards to act in such an undignified manner. It needs to be avoided. We have to realize that, you know, we're Jews, and we have limits and standards. We have to act with certain dignity and honor. And actions which are going to cause us to stoop down and do something which is just totally distasteful, inappropriate, we have to avoid. In the same paragraph, Maimonides points out that the rabbis teach us you're not supposed to watch animals mating either. You shouldn't watch animals mating. There's no Torah prohibition against that, but it's inappropriate. It's beneath our dignity. Why should we watch such a lowly act? So therefore, the Rambam says the Torah prohibits us from crossbreeding animals just so we have to avoid being involved in such actions. And it's an important lesson for you to understand that we have to see ourselves as, you know, princes and princesses. We are the children of God. God chose us. And some actions, you know, as beneficial as they may be productive, they may cause us to make profits, they may help our farms and help our businesses, but if it's something which is just undignified and just distasteful, it's not a becoming of a prince, of a princess, of a king or queen, we shouldn't be engaged in it. You know, there's a Yiddish term people use, it's pasnished. You know, it's just not appropriate. Just, you know, you don't do it. Does it, you know, many of these things the Torah doesn't prohibit. You can say, it's, you know, the Torah doesn't prohibit this, you know, there's no law against it, but it's just not for me. No, I don't do these types of things. It's unbecoming of a Jew. So that's what the Rambam's pointing out. This mitzvah is teaching us that things which are just inappropriate to be involved in, undignified, you shouldn't stoop down to that level as a Jew. That's the Rambam's teaching us. You know, it's, if they mate on their own, that's not a problem, because the actual production of a mule or of any crossbreed animal is not the issue. The issue is, Rambam says, engaging yourself in helping it to produce. It reminds me of a cute story that I heard. Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman tells a story. He's a great speaker, but Rabbi Kellerman, I've heard him before. Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman tells a story about he was with the children, he was going on like some sort of outing, vacation, and they live in Israel, so you take the buses, and everyone goes in the bus. He has the whole family on a bus, and one of the little kids has to use the bathroom. Now, when you're on one of these long bus trips on the Egged bus line in Israel, there's no bathroom on the bus, they're not stopping for you. You know, they're not stopping for you at all. This poor kid, I don't know how long it was, an hour, 2 hours, he's trying to hold it in. You know, he's in the bathroom. And finally, like, the kid's like ready to burst, you know? So finally they get off at wherever the station is, and the bus station bathroom's out of order. Right? So the whole family is like running up and down the street trying to find like a bathroom for this kid to use. This kid's like in pain now. So one of the kids runs into, and in Israel, sometimes the schools are not so helpful when they use their bathrooms, as if you've experienced that before, you know? So one of these kids finally runs into a bar. And the bar had an open bathroom. So he runs out, so he goes to the bathroom in the bar over there. So this little kid said, I don't know what he knew what a bar was. So he explained to him, what's the bar? And the kid said, I can't go in there. You know, and what did he say? He said his parents always referred to him as Kadosh, you know, the Holy One. That's what they always called their kid. He said, my parents call me Kadosh. How can I walk into a bar? It's beneath me. Now, that was this little, I don't know how old he was, 5, 6 years old, something like that. Beautiful story, you know, but it's, you know, the kid understood that certain, you know, as bad as it was, he had to use the bathroom, you know, it was beneath his dignity to walk into a bar. He didn't feel like, as a holy human being, I don't want to enter into an environment like that. You know, so I always like that story where Kellerman tells, he actually tells it in a much longer way, with a lot of, you know, very funny, the way he tells it, you know, he's very creative in how he speaks. Ultimately, we have to all have that attitude, that certain things for us, you know, even though you can't find any law in the Torah which says don't do it, and society might be acceptable, but you say, you know, I'm a Jew, and this is not something a Jew does. You know, that's something we have to recognize. So that's one idea in terms of why we can't crossbreed animals. But that's the Rambam's approach. But there's a kind of a main approach. This is a more common approach by other commentators, Nachmanides, Sefer Chinuch, and others. And they point out the following, that when God made the world, in Parshas Bereishis, we read a few weeks ago, when God made the world, he made species, and the Torah points out, Leminehem, to its species, to its kind. Every species is made specifically. The birds are made in their species, and animals in their species. All species were dominated by God. God saw the world, it says, and at the end of creation, the Arokim is called Asherah, saw, God saw all that he made, he told him, he said it was very good. So God scrutinized his handiwork, and God says everything's beautiful, everything's perfect, just as I want it. Now, if we start intervening and creating new species, it's a declaration that could be understood in a few different negative contexts. It could be declaring that God missed something. You know, God made horses, and God made donkeys, but God didn't realize he could have made a mule too. I think I should make a mule. And you're saying that I could do better than God, I could add to God's creation, I can help him out. There's some declaration there of insulting God's creation. Because you're showing that species that God made, or you know, that God missed out on a few species, and I was able to pull together and make that species myself. Now, what might bother you, but let me speak a moment before I ask your question. You know, the question that I had on this, which bothered me, but I think we can distinguish, is that, you know, let's say a new invention, right? Somebody comes out and creates the computer, right? I can say, well, God did create a computer. The human being created a computer. So am I insulting God? I'm saying, well, wait a minute. You know, God missed out on something. He could have made a computer at creation, and I came along and I'm saying that God forgot. God missed out. God, you know, God's creation is incomplete, right? So we have to make some sort of distinction, because we're supposed to, the Torah says, keeps you to conquer the world. We're supposed to harness the world, harness its powers, harness nature, create, that's positive, that's recommended, that's told that the human being is supposed to be able to control the world. That's what it says in the book of Bereishis. When the human being is created, God says, V'chivshua, you should conquer the land. Conquer the land is understood in its broader sense. We should be able to harness the world and use it for what we need. On the other hand, making a new species is different. So I think the difference would be that some things can be viewed as that I'm taking what God created and I'm just kind of clicking it all together. Sometimes a new species is qualitatively different. I think that's the difference. I mean, I think the question sort of remains in some ways. But if, you know, any invention which is made is taking, you know, different powers that God put into the world and just clicking them together in the right way, and out comes a new invention. So again, I'm simplifying it, but you know, you have your materials for a car, you just kind of put them all together in the right order, you end up with a car. It's a simplification, but that's what it is. However, when you make a new species, it's as if you created something which is totally, qualitatively new. You didn't just slap together different things and make an invention, but you've actually produced something which didn't exist before. So that's my suggestion in terms of understanding that. But there has to be this recognition that God's creation is perfect, is complete, and we aren't here to help out God or create things which God forgot about. Yeah. Correct. So I think the difference is that when it comes to something like the bris or making bread, those are things the Torah says this is man's duty, this is man's role in the world. Because we're supposed to act to perfect the world in many ways. However, the species, the Torah says these are the species. These are the animals created, let me naham to their kind, and doesn't tell us go make more. God says you should make a bris. God says you should go and produce bread and farm and work. God tells us to do those things. When it comes to species, God said, these are the species. This is what we have. Let me naham. This is what is there. This is the right kinds. That should be. I think that's the distinction. Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Then you can also argue that, you know, without the horse and the donkey, we couldn't make the mule either. Right? I mean, you still have that same argument with anything, that whatever I produce, I'm starting with God's raw materials. Right? So you still end up with that question.
Raw materials are God.
Right.
Properties of putting zero and one.
Right. That's true.
Beyond
that. Right. It's true. It's all true. So that distinction has to be made in some way. But We understand that there is certainly a realm where the human being is supposed to accomplish and produce, and there's certainly a realm where we're supposed to say this is God's perfection and we shouldn't mess with it. Another point made in terms of creating new species is that, you know, if God didn't create it, then maybe what we created is something which is causing imperfection in the world. I mean, why don't we ask, why didn't God make a mule, right? Maybe God felt that mules are not appropriate to have in the world. There's something negative about a mule. We shouldn't have mules in the world. And if I go and I create a mule, I've actually added to the world's imperfection. So not only am I declaring, so on the one hand, I'm declaring that God missed out on something. God forgot about the mule. On the other hand, God did have a good reason not to make a mule, right? So if God didn't make a mule, why am I making a mule? Maybe I'm doing something which is bringing something negative into the world. And we don't always see the negative impact, but you never know. I mean, I was thinking that maybe this is kind of a source for people wanting to eat only natural foods. Because when God made food as it's supposed to be healthy and nutritious, if we start meddling with the foods, if we start adding in preservatives and artificial flavors, it's a negative thing. You know, there's something to that, for sure. So when I start adding a mule into the world, again, that's just our common example is a mule, I'm adding something that God said maybe shouldn't be in this world. Maybe the mule has some negative impact. You know, we don't know what it is. It could be physical, it could be spiritual, but maybe we should avoid the mule. So that's another understanding given in terms of creating the species. A third understanding given, I mean, again, all relating to the same topic, is that when you start creating new species, you are trying to act like God. And that's something which is inappropriate for a human being. You know, for us to think, I'm going to be... So, there are many realms where we should create, but in a realm where we're not supposed to create, if we start trying to create something new, a new species, then we're trying to act godlike. And it's not appropriate for a human being. Again, we're supposed to be godly in terms of how we act or characteristics, try to be spiritual. But if we're supposed to say, I'm as powerful as God, that I can create a brand new animal. So that's a statement which is, you know, a little bit beyond where the human being should be messing with. So that's another understanding given. So this is all coming, so this idea of creating a new species of animal, we have these two different approaches. One approach, the Rambam, that we shouldn't be involved in such lowly activities. And the other approach, which is the general approach, that creating a new species is a negative statement, whether it be because we are showing that we're trying to say that we can help that God and make the world better, whether it be that we're creating something which is imperfect, that God didn't want in the world, or whether it be that we're acting a little bit too much like God, but all falls in the same category, that we should not be creating new species. Now, a lot of this also could apply, yeah?
You're talking about using them by putting the two animals together in the cage, or what if a person knows they're going to mate together, you know, some male and female, say, you know, a horse and a donkey together,
right,
on purpose with the intention of them, you know, hopefully mating.
Right, so Turner prohibits that, I guess because at that point you could say it wasn't my fault. You know, even though you know it might happen, but, you know, it was the animal's decision, it wasn't my fault, so that's not my responsibility. But the Torah doesn't prohibit that. Then a lot of these ideas also could apply to mixing in terms of plants. If you were to graft trees, create a new species of plant, create a new fruit. So it's a very similar concept if you're creating something new. So there's nothing inappropriate about it. The Rambam's reason wouldn't apply. It's not undignified to graft a tree. But yet, if you create a new species of tree or plant based on the fact that you've grafted it or planted them together or mixed them, so there we can understand that there is some sort of statement that I'm trying to perfect God's world or bring one of these things we said before. Additionally, the Rambam, Maimonides, points out in terms of mixing plants. He says, and again, he comes from earlier philosophical works. The Rambam was well versed in Jewish and non-Jewish philosophy. And the Rambam writes that people used to graft and crossbreed plants as a superstitious practice, an idolatrous practice. It was good luck to plant grapes with your grain, apparently. They also would engage sometimes in lewd conduct when they were grafting their fruits. Rambam writes, very strange thing, but I guess if they're grafting fruits, they'd also graft people in certain ways, you know, inappropriate conduct. So Rambam says the Torah prohibited these things because they were related to superstitious or idolatrous practices in the ancient world. What's interesting is that we have a certain, it's more strict when you involve grapes in the mixture, when there's no grapes in the mixture. And just to recap what we said before, you're not supposed to plant seeds together, mix a bunch of seeds and plant them together. You have to keep your crops separate in the land of Israel. You're not supposed to graft fruits or graft trees, you know, insert a branch of one tree into another, etc. But the outcome is what you're allowed to use. So if someone was to graft a tree or to mix plants, you're allowed to eat the fruits. It's not a problem. However, if grapes are involved, if you were to plant grains around a grapevine, then all of the produce is forbidden. You have to destroy it all. You're supposed to burn it, you know, to a crisp. Nothing left. You're supposed to do. So why is it that grapes are more strict? So Sefer HaChinuch writes something very interesting. Sefer HaChinuch writes that, number one, it's showing us, we know that the grapevine is considered very significant in Jewish thoughts. We make kiddush on grapes, a special blessing we make on grapes, prepare guffin. Many mitzvahs are done over a cup of wine. Wine has significance to it. Four cups of wine on Pesach. So you might think a grape is something which is so important, so significant, it sets itself apart, that no matter what you mix with it, it's not going to overpower the grape. The grape's going to remain the grape no matter what you do. They don't care about other things around the grape. So Torah is more strict about a grape. And he says, what's the understanding of this? It's that we know that there's a big difference between mixing grapes and mixing other things is that you can't eat the produce of the grapes when they're mixed, you could eat the produce of other vegetables. He says, why? Because, you know, the primary purpose of a grape is going to be the wine. That's how we understand a grape's purpose is to make wine. That's how we look at it. Halakhically, that is the significant usage of grapes in the world, even to this very day. So we all know the challenges posed by alcohol. You know, it was a challenge in their times, a challenge in our times. And alcohol is something which could be used in very positive ways, and also can destroy lives. And we all know how it works in both ways. And the Torah tells us you should make kiddush on wine, and because if you use it in very positive ways, it can add to your joy. It's an enjoyable drink. It creates friendships. Wine is something which could be used in a very positive manner. But yet, when you misuse alcohol, it's very destructive. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes, why should we add to our challenge by having the production of the grapes in a sinful manner as well? But you're not supposed to mix crops. Now, if you mix crops and an apple is involved, okay, so then there's nothing, an apple doesn't pose any risk to you. Even though the beginning of this apple was sinful, it's not going to add any more risk to the apple because an apple itself is neutral. There's nothing wrong with an apple. But since grapes, which produce wine, itself is always risky. Whenever you start drinking, it's always a risk being taken. There's always a challenge a person has in order to use alcohol appropriately. So therefore, you might think, you know, you might have a problem because why should you add even more to your challenge? If the grape itself had a sinful beginning, it's more likely to cause you an issue down the road. Now, it could be understood in a spiritual sense, we have an idea of avera gerer severa. Sin can cause another sin. So if you already began the production of this grape in a sinful manner by mixing it with other crops, and then you start drinking the wine, it could be that the origins of this wine are going to cause you to use the wine inappropriately. There's some sort of spiritual influence involved. And it's more likely that the wine will be used incorrectly if it began in its origins in a sinful manner. So therefore, the Sefer Chinuch writes that the Torah tells us that if you were to have grapes involved in your mixing of fruits, not only is it forbidden to mix those fruits with the grape, but the grape is forbidden, everything's forbidden, don't drink it, destroy it, because things with sinful origins often have the power to cause you to veer off the track even more down the road. That's what he writes. Interesting thing. And I think you understand it on the spiritual level. We have a concept called a sin can cause another sin. I mean, one person, if you're involved in inappropriate conduct, often leads to another. You know, just we have it in a physical plane. And people talk about, like, they believe they call marijuana a gateway drug. What does that mean? Marijuana itself may not be so terrible, so bad for your health. But people who start on one drug usually gravitate towards more drugs and to more dangerous drugs and more addictive drugs. And that's kind of what we see in the physical realm. But in the spiritual realm, you have it as well. You know, we have our Yetzirah Tov, our inclination towards good, we have Yetzirah Hara, inclination towards evil. So the more good we do, the more powerful our Yetzirah Tov gets, the more good we want to do. People who are involved in good want to do more good. If you do chesed, you want to do more chesed. If you get stuck, you want to get more stuck. If you feel good, you feel positive, you feel upbeat, you feel, you know, it creates a very good feeling in the person. People who get involved in inappropriate activities, they fall down into a rut, and often that leads to more and more inappropriate activities. You know, people engage in theft and cheating and dishonesty, so often it's, you know, there's a snowball effect and it leads to more. And on a spiritual plane, the more we give strength to our Yetzer Hara, to the inclination towards evil, then Yetzer Hara will act upon us in an even more dangerous and stronger sense. So it applies on a spiritual and physical level. So when you have your grapes, which are produced in sin, those grapes themselves carry within them an ability to cause you to use the wine inappropriately. Whereas if the grapes are produced in a permissible sense, so then you're left with the regular challenge of alcohol. That's what you're left with. So that's the Sefer Chinuch writes. That's the other interesting point you get from that, which is kind of a side topic, but it's also an interesting point you have in this discussion, is the Jewish view on drinking. You know, how should Jews view drinking? You know, it's funny that there is this concept out there that, like, Jews don't drink. You know, drinking is not a Jewish thing. On the other hand, you know, Jews certainly do drink. And, you know, every Friday night we're supposed to sit down with a cup of wine. And the Pesach, 4 cups of wine. And on Purim, there's an idea of drinking wine. And every holiday we drink wine. At a bris we drink wine. At a wedding we drink wine. So, I mean, there's definitely something about drinking for a Jew. Usually it's wine. It's not other forms of alcohol. You know, wine is usually what we're discussing here. But the Jewish view on drinking is that the verse tells us in Psalms, Yayin Samach Levav Enosh, that wine can give joy to the heart, and wine can make us happy, can put us in a very positive mood. Wine is something which helps us to enjoy what's around us. We can enjoy a meal, we can enjoy a simcha, we have a little bit of wine, and it helps enhance our enjoyment. I think the big distinction is if the wine becomes your enjoyment or the wine enhances your enjoyment. The idea of the wine on Shabbos is not that the wine should create your happiness on Shabbos, but the wine should add your happiness on Shabbos. So a person should appreciate Shabbos, first should appreciate a holiday, first should be happy to perform a mitzvah, to be at a bris, to be at a wedding. And then the wine should then enhance that happiness, because the wine has the ability to bring out more, and to enter into us and to bring out more emotion and more feeling. However, if the wine becomes our happiness, that's where it gets very dangerous, because if the wine is happiness, we want more and more wine, because it makes you happier and happier. And then that's where people kind of that's where addictions develop, and that's where wine becomes a very dangerous and destructive thing. So the Jewish view on wine is that it poses a challenge. It's supposed to be used. It was used on the altar. In the temple itself, they'd offer wine libations. And that was the way that we would offer wine to God, which shows us how wine is so significant and important to us. However, it all depends on the attitude. If the attitude is that this wine is here to enhance my joy and connect me with others and with God and to enhance my feelings of joy on Shabbos or on Yom Tov, then it's a very, very good thing. And usually, if that's the attitude, then you're able to control how much you drink. Because at a certain point you realize that the wine is taking me away from my Shabbos enjoyment and getting me a little bit too drunk. However, when the wine becomes the enjoyment, then you better be careful. And that I believe is the Jewish view on wine. So when that wine begins in a sinful manner, then you should be extra careful. And that's what the Sefer Chinuch is writing, that at that point the wine becomes prohibited, and you should not drink that wine at all. There's another, the next section of Kilayim, I think will take us longer than 3 minutes. We'll just introduce it right now, but probably continue next week. The next section of Kilayim that I want to discuss is this idea of not plowing with a donkey and an ox together. You should not plow with a donkey and ox together. Now, the major difference you have with this one versus the other ones, the other ones are actually physically uniting two things and creating new species. You crossbreed animals, you crossbreed plants, and that actually can physically produce something new. If you just tie together a donkey and an ox and have them tied to your wagon, it pulls your wagon. So have this to be they're both pulling your wagon, but there's no actual fusion between two of them. I mean, it's a very different type of kilayim. So we have to understand when the Torah says don't plow the shore with an ox and a donkey, what does it mean? Just understand what the halacha entails. Rashi tells us that it doesn't just mean a donkey and an ox, and then this is quoting from the Gemara, but actually the Torah prohibition includes this. It's any two species. However, the main opinion seems to be that the Torah prohibition only as if it's one kosher and one non-kosher species. The examples given are an ox and a donkey. An ox is kosher, a donkey is not. So therefore, most authorities agree that the Torah prohibition is only if you're dealing with tying together a kosher and non-kosher species and having them work for you. However, the rabbis prohibited any two species. So even though the Torah may only prohibit kosher or non-kosher, the rabbis prohibit any two species together. A human being pulling a wagon with an animal is okay. You know, we're not considered animals, according to Torah thought, and therefore you can't have two animals together, but a human being pulling along with an animal is fine, it's not a problem. The reason the Torah chose, just on a simple level, to give us the examples of an ox and a donkey is because that's a common example. You know, when you're a farmer and you're trying to have your tractor pulled, you know, you're pulling your plow, so how is your plow, so the common animals used were donkeys and oxen. That was very common in those days. So that's why they were used by the Torah. However, it would apply to other animals as well. Interesting question is that the Talmud is unsure if you're allowed to have a land species and a water species pulling the plow together. So it's just a funny example to think about. You have a farm right next to the ocean, and the whale comes by. You know, so you harness the whale and you harness your ox, and they pull together, you know, that kind of thing. So again, I don't know where it would actually apply in regular life. You know, if you're dealing with like a whale or a dolphin or something, I don't think a fish could pull your plow. But if you were to harness a whale and harness an ox together, would that be prohibited by the Torah or not? The Gemara is not sure about that. That's a question the Gemara has, not an answer. Either way, it'd be prohibited rabbinically, if not prohibited biblically. Again, I don't think it's going to be that relevant to us, but it's an interesting thing to think about. So that's the rules of plowing with a donkey and an ox. And even though the Torah says plowing, it means any sort of work, whether it be pulling a load, pulling a plow, and any sort of work where you're tying together two separate species, having them work for you, that is this prohibition. So I think we'll stop here. Next week, God willing, we'll discuss what is the lesson you have from this mitzvah, and also we'll discuss shatnez, wearing the wool linen together. Any questions? Yeah.